the soul of a rabbi in the body of a woman. In the entrancing legends of the Hasidic universe, where exotic and colorful individuals abound, they call her the Maiden of Ludmir, or the Holy Virgin of Ludmir, or simply the Virgin of Ludmir. Her admirers and followers rushed from all corners of the province of Volnia in Poland to drink in her words and receive her blessings. Now, who was she? To better place her exotic destiny in the context of Jewish tradition, let us briefly recall the role that women have in it. It is not unimportant. In fact, far from it. First of all, taken in its entirety, Jewish history seems inconceivable without the women. No history can exist without women. After all, the history of humankind began with a woman. And what a woman. Naturally, we Jews remember our matriarchs. We admire Abraham, but we love Sarah. We follow Jacob as he becomes Israel, but we weep with and for Rachel. Oh, we know so much about Moses' sister Miriam, and she remains a source of strength and healing in our collective memory. We remember Yael and her part in the defeat of Sisera during the turbulent times in the book of Judges. How can we not remember Deborah, the prophetess and poetess, and Huldah, the prophetess? We know that Michal, King Saul's daughter, were Tefillin, the phylacteries. And Rashi tells us that the sages then didn't object. How can we not remember Bruria, the great Bruria, the erudition incarnate, she who threw fear into the great man of her generation? She knew too much. But some Talmudic scholars were not too kind to women. We must be honest and frank. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, one of the pillars of Talmud, opposed education for women. And he said, whoever teaches Torah to women as if to teach them frivolous, silly things. He said something strange: let Torah scrolls be burned rather than fall into their hands. Rabbi Meir, Bruria's husband, maintained that women were feeble-minded. But in the vast ocean of Talmud, we always find ideas and their opposites. Whatever we know from both sides. For instance, we know that in the 14th century, a certain Rabbi David Yosef, Ben Yosef Ubadram, said, why are women freed from accomplishing certain mitzvot, certain commandments? And the simple answer, he says, because so it will give them time to obey their husband's will. Well, today, King Solomon, the wisest of all men, said, one man among thousand I found, a woman among thousand I have not. Now, where is his wisdom to say something like that, knowing that women will hear it? Maybe he said it when he was already old. Or maybe he said it actually with a question mark, saying, what? I haven't found a woman? Impossible. Now, therefore, remember, don't hold it against the Talmud. The Talmud has so many versions of so many by so many sages on so many subjects, always for and against. We can quote you so many things in praise of women, but this is not the time. Remember only Rabbi Akiva, the great Rabbi Akiva, who was in love with his wife all his life, Rachel, and naturally, therefore, his attitude, even in halakha, always was pro-women. So don't worry. But nevertheless, the same is true of Hasidic literature. In Hasidic literature, actually, right from the beginning, we know that women occupied a special place. It was almost created for women. The Besht, the master of the good name, spoke to female audiences in marketplaces, festivals, community events. His main audience was women. Hasidic tales attracted women by their simple and wondrous natures. Naturally, it must also be true. Later on, there was a problem. There was a problem that somehow sociologically, women did not play the major role. For instance, even in my time, there were Hasidim who would leave their wives and children on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, on holidays in general, to go and spend the holidays with their rabbis. Now, it therefore created problems to families. But nevertheless, they all accepted the idea that Hasidism has certain laws, certain traditions, which may change in times. As for famous women, many miraculous legends are attributed to Udel, the daughter of the master of the good name. We are told that her intelligence, piety, and talents were out of the ordinary. And much praise is given to Udel in her role as daughter, that she sometimes gave advice to her father. And such stories are not astonishing, since according to rumor and legend, the Besht had drawn her very name from scripture. Udel Aleph Dalet Lamet are the initials of the words Eish Dat Lamo. Holy fire ignites her faith. Of course, seasoned skeptics prefer another, more modern explanation. According to them, the name comes simply from Yiddish. Udel comes actually from French, and the French name is Adele. So the Adele becomes Odel. But skeptics never liked Hasidic Jews, and the feeling was actually quite mutual. One of the principles of the Hasidic experience is what we call emunat tzadikim, faith in a tzadik. And the tzadik puts doubt to rest. As for Udel, the daughter, the story goes that she accompanied her father in his travels. And one morning, as when he was home, she entered her father's bedroom to invite him for lunch. And the father reprimanded her for having bothered him, because he was in the middle of talking with the prophet Elijah and his master, Achia HaShiloni. And as soon as the two visitors heard the girl's voice, they went away. Apparently, the father, therefore, was not pleased with his daughter. But in general, father and daughter were always together at home or in their journeys. She watched the Besht with his disciples. They understood each other. Little mention is made of the Besht's wife, whereas much is said of his daughter, who was able to quote from the sacred texts. Some say that the Besht raised her as a disciple and had taught her the art of healing illnesses, both common and obscure. In reality, Udel is not the only woman who took on the responsibilities of a rabbi at the time. The Maggid of Kozhenitz's daughter, Perele, the mother of Rabbi Yitzchak Meir of Ger, the founder of Chabad, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi's daughter, Freide, Mirish, Rabbi Elimelech of Lizensk's daughter, Chaye, Rabbi Meir of Premishlan's daughter, like their fathers, all received requests for and offered blessings, and perhaps with the same success. But none attained the prestige and radiance of the Maiden of Lublin. She does deserve to be known for the mystery which surrounds her name and her destiny. So who was she? She herself did not write anything. Her disciples and loyal followers surely spoke of her, but left nothing behind on paper. In other words, you understand that this makes any research on her astonishing career difficult, because the only material that we possess comes from rumors and oral accounts, and not from direct testimony. Shmuel Abba Horodetsky, Mordechai Biber, Yohanan Tversky, Menashe Unger, David Meckler, Shloime Ansky, and recently a brilliant young historian, Nathaniel Deutsch, have looked into her remarkable fate. Articles, tales, novels, and plays, as well as doctoral theses and dissertations, are devoted to her. But the biographical elements collected pretty much everywhere appear so vague, so distant, so contradictory and odd, so astounding, particularly so imaginary in nature, that they throw her very existence into question. And yet she was very much alive and well and active. We know her place of birth, her own and her father's name, though not her mother's. We even know, or actually think we know, her frame of mind and its expressions, which brought her much admiration on the one hand and hostility on the other. Her name was Hannah Rochel. She was red-headed. She was a dreamer. She was the only daughter of a man named Monish Werbermacher, a wealthy businessman from a small town in Volnia called Vladimir in Ukrainian and Ludmir in Yiddish. Her actual date of birth, however, has not been determined. Some sources indicate 1805, while others put it 10 years later, closer to the death of the three great Hasidic masters, the Magid Rabbi Israel of Kozhenitz, the Seer of Lublin, Rabbi Mendel of Rimanov, all implicated during the Napoleonic Wars in the tragic so-called messianic conspiracy to hasten mystically the redemption of the Messiah, that much to the regret of their whole generation and ours, was destined to fail. Most attribute her birth, though, in 1806. We know that her parents were childless for 10 years. After 10 years, a husband had the right to divorce his wife, but she persuaded him to continue, at which end, awaiting some kind of miracle, she had suggested to him that the great Rabbi Motel of Chernobyl intercede on their behalf and to have a child. But which of them went to seek the blessing of the Hasidic master, the husband or the wife? To this day, we don't know. We even wonder if Monish, the father, was close to the Hasidic movement at all. One thing is true, the tzaddik, the just man, the master, promised them they would have a child the following year. Both father and mother would have preferred a son. They had a daughter. Was she tall or short, scrawny or in full bloom, slow-moving or energetic? Did she have a low voice, or perhaps solemn or shy? We have no idea. All we know is that from a very young age, she liked to pray with kavana, with condensation, with concentration. She liked to study assiduously. One legend says that once, while still very young, she refused to touch her dinner. When questioned, the butcher later admitted that her meat was not kosher. A miracle? There will be others to come. While still a teenager, she fell in love with a student. That was not a miracle. But she was unable to approach him prior to their marriage. Who was he? Here again, we are in the dark. Was it a boy near whom she sat on the cheder school benches, or maybe a yeshiva bocher, a student at the yeshiva, noticed during services? Perhaps a Jewish soldier forcibly recruited by the imperial army of the Tsar. That was the custom then. It happened very often then, that they were kidnapped, Jewish boys were kidnapped by the Tsar's army. In that case, what was his name? David? Meir? Both names appear in the legend. But was it in fact just a legend? It's possible. It seems as though she spoke of him to her parents, who naturally were against it. This was a time when the daughter of a good family didn't fall in love just like that, with all the encouragement or even the initiative of her parents. The daughter held her ground and her parents gave in. Yet this love was more than likely purely platonic. There would have been no physical relationship between them. Would they have arranged secret rendezvous? Impossible. It simply was not done. Her father found another suitor for marriage, but his daughter would hear none of it. When she protested, saying that she didn't love him, Monash replied, "But who said that a woman should love her promised one?" True or not, David Meckler, a researcher, claims that on this issue, her mother took her side and on her deathbed begged her husband not to force Hannah Rochel to act against her will. And I quote, "I can see," said the mother, "that my days are numbered. I ask only one thing of you. Do not give Hannah Rochel away in marriage too soon. Do not do anything without her knowledge or approval. Consult her before concluding any such agreement with the suitor's family. I will no longer be here, so she should be the one to speak for herself." "But for the love of God," the husband exclaimed, "since when should parents ask for the opinion of their children in such affairs?" "What the mother and father decide will be done." "No," answered the dying mother, "not Hannah Rochel. She is different. Promise me not to force her. That is my last wish." And of course, her husband made his vow that she longed for. Again, was this an actual exchange or was it completely made up? After all, Meckler was not there for this interaction. Could he have heard it from someone who was there? What is certain is that the girl became motherless while still young. All the more astonishing that Hannah Rochel, the daughter, said the Kaddish prayer for her, which wasn't done then. Only men said Kaddish. And several accounts confirm witnessing Hannah Rochel depressed, despondent, going alone to gather her thoughts while mourning at her mother's grave. Once when she was 13 years old, she fainted there. She stayed in a coma for several days or more. Mordechai Biber tells the story of her afflicted father going to lie over his wife's grave and asking his wife to intercede from above for their daughter. And then he went to see Rabbi Motl of Chernobyl with this same prayer. "You had promised us a daughter," meaning a living daughter, "and it falls on you to keep her alive for us." And the tzaddik reassured him, "Go home. You will find her revived. She will bring you much joy and a good deal of grief." And that is how she came back from the coma. According to the legend, the prophecy of the tzaddik was entirely fulfilled. Had she bumped her head against the tombstone? Why did she fall in a coma? Some explain it this way. Others talk instead about an incident more mystical in origin and substance. According to the latter version, Hannah Rochel passed out and had a vision. A vision in which she saw herself in heaven before the celestial tribunal, which was to decide her fate. Should she live or die? After some deliberation, they decided to grant her a new soul made of pure spirituality. Was it the soul of a tzaddik in search of a refuge? Here we are again, though from a rather narrow angle in Anski's literary realm, except that here the metamorphosis is less dramatic. Her admirers say that Hannah Rochel was changed when she awoke. She suddenly archived biblical, Talmudic, and mystical knowledge that no woman and very few men at her age had. Was this before the funeral or after? Frustrated by her love with the boy that she was in love with? Or full of despair without her mother, Hannah Rochel, broke off her engagement, the new one, which turned out to be a turning point in her life? One can imagine the scandal in the community. It was in turmoil. Her fiancé's father demanded that Monish give back the gifts that his daughter had received, and that wasn't all. He also demanded a considerable payment for the harm done his son's reputation. In certain circles, in punishment, Hannah Rochel was forbidden access to the Weiberschule, the section for women in synagogue. It is during this time that she took on the veritable behavior of a man. She prayed 3 times a day. In the morning, she put on the tallit, prayer shawl, and wore phylacteries, 2 pairs of tefillin, those of Rashi and those of his grandson, Rabbeinu Tam. At 19, she mourned the passing of her father, and again, she said the Kaddish for him. Monish, the father, left her an estate of some size as an inheritance. She used it to have an oratory, a shtibel, constructed on the 2nd floor for her and those men and women faithful to her. More precisely, she addressed her sermons to them from an adjoining room, according to some, or from behind a sheet used as a curtain, according to others. She didn't want to be seen, only to be heard. Now, mind you, that is not entirely within the tradition. A woman's voice is perilous. It can give ideas. It can give some desires. Called Isha Erva, we are told. And nevertheless, men came to listen to her. Especially the occasion of the 3rd meal, the Shalosh Seudot for the Sabbath. She celebrated specially the 3rd meal, was the great culminating point. When imbued with mystical revelry, she, Hannah Rochel, revealed her inspired commentary of sacred texts. During the week, she welcomed visitors, who, according to Hasidic custom, gave her kvitlech, or written requests, explaining their health problems, family troubles, or financial predicaments. She, however, contrary to other masters, did not accept the pidyon, any monetary compensation for spiritual help. And this is where things take a turn to the worse. Her success antagonized many, particularly in the Hasidic circles, largely dominated by Reb Mendel of Chernobyl's grandson, the same who had sought divine intervention when Monish and his wife were trying to have a child. People began to whisper, and eventually less discreetly, that her activities showed that she was wearing away from the heritage of the Baal Shem Tov, the master of the good name. A pious woman is praiseworthy, so is a Hasidic woman. A woman well-versed in esoteric texts, okay, that is still acceptable. But a woman filling the role and functions of a rabbi is going too far. It's transgressing the tolerable limits. Even Bruria, the great Bruria, she was never a master. She was a great disciple who frightened the masters, but she never played the role of a master. So at this point in the story, I feel we must go back to Anski, whom we mentioned earlier. His account strikes me, because some of it comes from the mouth of a certain Yosele Dreyer at the time of his visit to Ludmir in 1915, during the war. Anski speaks of this in addressing the Jewish ethnographic expedition to which he belonged. And he would go around, actually, Eastern Europe, to collect stories, to collect events, to create a forum for historians, for future historians, of a place or of places or of times that people might forget and were maybe doomed to be forgotten. And here is what he says, Anski. The entire region buzzed with the maiden of Ludmir. Not only men and women, but also scholars and rabbis from surrounding towns used to come to her as a holy person so that she could bless them. She used to sit in her room near open doors, and everyone would stand in the house of study and listen to her homilies. A group of followers formed around her, who men called simply the Hasidim of the Maiden of Ludmir. Tzaddikim from this time came to take a look at this wonder woman. They tried to convince her that she should change her way of life and get settled, as all women do. Around that time, the eminent tzaddik, the Motel of Chernobyl, set out to plead with her to marry. She yielded and was married to a rabbi. However, they quickly got divorce. End of quotes, written by Anski. So in this important account, we learn that for the second time in her life, the illustrious Rabbi Motel of Chernobyl enters the picture. Sought out by adversaries of the Virgin, he has a long discussion with her. Once again, it's unclear who went to see the other. Opinions differ, but we know what they talked about. Rabbi Motel explained that her Hasidic method, her Hasidic way, were new. Therefore, contrary to the tradition established by the Baal Shem Tov. And she answered that since she had received a life and a soul from the heavenly tribunal itself, it was within her right to form them, to shape them, to give them new or old meanings. And what about the rest? The tzaddik was unable to come up with any argument against her desire to study ancient texts. In fact, she could have cited, and according to some sources, she did cite, the example of other scholarly women. Likewise, he could not reasonably hold her piety against her. Doesn't a Jewish woman need to know the law to fulfill divine will? What's wrong with learning? But in fact, on this issue, the Rabbi of Chernobyl could cling to a biblical commandment to undermine the female Rabbi's position, the one on procreation. Hadn't God commanded Adam and Eve, soon after giving them life, to be fertile and multiply on the earth? It could have been, an irrefutable argument to which there was nothing Hannah Rochel could say. And the fact is, she said nothing. And the fact is, after this argument, she gave in. And with time, she accepted marriage. We know this for sure. But whom did she marry? Some say a young Talmud scholar from an excellent but poor family. Others say no, she married a simple gentleman. How can we know? The consensus is nonetheless that there was a marriage. But of course this event, like so many others with the Virgin of Ludmir, has several conflicting versions. Some texts describe the wedding feast arranged by the groom's father and worthy of her status, with musicians and sumptuous meals for the rich and poor, while others insist that it was, according to the bride's wishes, a simple ritualistic ceremony kept to a minimum. Was there a marriage? There's a marvelous anecdote, an anecdote which gives us a feeling of what one does when history is mixed with imagination, and we don't really know what is what. And the anecdote is about two men in a restaurant, and one of them calls the waiter and says, "Waiter, it's so hot in this restaurant. Can you put on the air conditioner?" He said, "Of course, sir." 10 minutes later, the same man called him, "Now, it's too cold. Can you turn it off? He said, "Of course." 10 minutes later, off and on, off and on. So the other customer calls the waiter and says, "This man is driving you crazy, doesn't he?" He said, "He's driving me crazy. I'm driving him crazy. There is no air conditioner." So naturally, we think of these three and we wonder, where is the truth? Of course, all three may be guilty. The waiter for lying, the first customer for complaining for nothing, and for the second customer for mixing into something which he had no business getting into. So we have the same thing here. Where is the air conditioner? Was there a wedding? Maybe there wasn't a wedding, but yes, wedding. But we had to give an interpretation and give different versions, and there were versions. But usually we believe that there was a wedding because everyone agrees on what happened next after the wedding. It was sad, disappointing. We don't know. Did the wedding, if it was a wedding, last one day, one night, one week? Supposedly the young bride did not attend the special meals during the marriage week. It also seems, and with some degree of certainty, that the marriage was never consummated. Was this because of the wife's resistance or her young husband's timidity? One explanation has been that already considering herself spiritually untouchable, she insisted on remaining untouched. But another is also that the new husband, he dreaded coming close to his young wife's body. In the meantime, he had no doubt taken her disturbing reputation as a woman of superior and saintly qualities too seriously. Another researcher, Charles Ruddock, describes the young husband as a scribe older than she. Some sources say that she chased him from her house and demanded an immediate divorce. Was this change too radical for those already set in their ways? Rumors flew. Amused in the beginning, some became hostile, inflexible. People did not quite go to the point of accusing the virgin of being a witch, but to undermine her reputation, there were those who spread rumors that she was possessed. And some even used her own remarks about having a new soul to explain her eccentric behavior. So it all boiled down, according to those circles, to what we call a D-book. This is exactly from where, says Nathaniel Deutsch, Anski draws the theme for his spellbinding play, first entitled Between Two Worlds, and then the D-book, a play that takes one's breath away. I believe it to be one of the great plays of the world's repertoire. His theme deserves to be discussed. At its most simple core, it is the story of a betrayed friendship. Two poor friends in a yeshiva, somewhere in Eastern Europe, feel close enough to make this vow. If later on they marry, and one of them has a son, and the other a daughter, their children will marry one another. It so happens that things go otherwise. One became rich, and the other remained poor. The rich one had a daughter, Leah, and the poor one had a son, Chonon. And without going into detail, let's just say that the children were destined to for each other and loved each other. And the rich friend forgot his promise. One of the most captivating characters of the play is the messenger, the Meshulach, a mysterious vagabond who arrives from somewhere to go wherever, anywhere, in order to clarify the meaning of something invisible and explain the inexplicable. It is he who, in speaking to the nouveau riche friend, offers this marvelous image. He says, the difference between rich and poor is, if you stand in front of a window, you see people. If you stand in front of the window which is covered with silver or gold, it becomes a mirror, and you see only yourself. And in this play, there is preparation for a wedding. A wedding that will not take place. For, as in Ludmir, Leah, the bride-to-be, with her broken heart, goes to the cemetery to visit her mother's grave. Once there, she follows a tradition to invite her mother to her wedding ceremony. As in Ludmir, in the play, Leah, the young girl, faints and then wakes up with a soul that doesn't belong to her. It is Chonon's soul, her actual fiancé, to whom she is bound by her parents' oath. I've seen this play and I've seen this film many, many times, and I suggest you can get it to see it. It's extraordinary. The strength, the power, the intensity, and the mystery and the mystical qualities of Chonon, who is a mystical student, and that is how he is actually lost before losing his soul to his bride. In the play, Leah is no longer herself. It is Chonon speaking through her mouth. She expresses the disappointment of a sick and unfortunate young man, and his words become an accusation against this world that denies pure love, true love, life-giving and mature love. So Anski, the author, must have heard echoes of the rumors about the Virgin of Ludmir, because he says so in his report. But the artist in him, the poet, the playwright, transformed the rumors and adapted them for his play. Now it became a love story, a romantic love story, a mystical love story. And love, life and art shared certain things in common, but nonetheless remain separate. And one illuminates the other and reaches the other. In Anski's play, there is, at the end of the play, a frightening scene of exorcism. It's a scene that strikes the imagination and makes you tremble. A minyan, 10 men wearing their prayer shawls and holding black candles, are there around the rabbi of Miropol, who is trying to chase the soul, the wandering soul, away from the body of the girl. It's an agonizing, disturbing, frightening ceremony. Reality and fantasy, passion and the occult, fright in the shadowy unknown and eternal truths become entangled with every scene. There is no exorcism in the story of Ludmir. Even if there are allusions here and there in certain circles to voices that could be heard chasing the Dybbuk, which had allegedly infiltrated the Virgin, her pain-stricken soul, nothing indicates any consequence to these talks. The conclusion of the story, it is just as nebulous as its origins. Hannah Rochel must have been in her 50s when she decided to leave her home in Ludmir and go live the rest of her life in Palestine. Why? To follow in the footsteps of the Besht, the Baal Shem Tov, who according to legend had tried several times to go there and thus bring about the final redemption. The story is that he wanted to go and meet a friend of his, whom he had never met, the Orach Chaim, Rabbi Chaim Ben Attar, from Morocco. They were in correspondence, and they were very, very fond of one another. They were close to one another. And legend had it, had they met, the Messiah would have come. And therefore the Baal Shem Tov tried three times to go, and each time Satan intervened and prevailed, and therefore the meeting never occurred. So was it maybe that she wanted to imitate the great Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav, who had succeeded in going there, and his journey to Palestine is one of the great jewels in literature, full of adventures, full of threats, full of perils, full of dangers, and each time how he escaped, how he survived. That should be a story written for novelists or more. Rabbi Nachman just arrived, had hardly had he set foot on the soil of the Holy Land, was already dreaming about going back into the diaspora. But he stayed longer. The fact is, why she left, we don't know. Maybe she ran away from her husband. It's possible. One thing is clear, she never left an explanation. We don't even know how she went there. Without doubt, by boat. There was no plane then. Through Romania, perhaps. Turkey. Who were her travel companions? We are not sure. What was her life in the Holy Land? We don't know. According to some, she tried to rebuild her reputation as a rabbi, a master, even there, by relying on her strengths, organizing prayers and groups for study and communal meditation. Others insist, on the contrary, that she did her best to remain anonymous. With what remained from her fortune, she was able to live comfortably. But we don't know where. In Safed, the epitome of mystical sights? In Jerusalem, perhaps, ever the capital of mystical dreamers. Years ago, in bringing her up briefly in the context of a longer discussion on Hasidism, I had done research on this extraordinary woman already. And I remember having discovered, but I forget where, that she passed her life in Palestine completely unknown and solitary. Am I mistaken? I also remember another source saying that she had been a laundry woman. A third source that she was a pharmacist. A scholar and historian, Ephraim Tabenhaus, gives us a portrait of this undoubtedly disconcerting woman taken from a diary kept by his father Meir, who knew her. They met in 1874. He describes her living in Mea Shearim, the neighborhood of Jerusalem, which is the most Haredi, the most Orthodox, the most pious. And he describes her as short, with gray hair, and the face glowing with a sacred light, sitting at a long table, presiding over a gathering of older women. Nathaniel Deutsch cites pieces of information about her based on Jewish sources belonging to Sir Moses Montefiore's archives. Sir Moses Montefiore was one of the great British Jewish personalities going around diaspora, helping communities and collecting thereto evidence on their life, on their struggle, on their work. Horodetsky relates that the Virgin of Ludmir had decided, along with a devotee of the Kabbalah, to use their secret knowledge in anticipation of the imminent coming of the Messiah. They even were to hide in a cellar near Jerusalem to carry this out. She was there. But, says Horodetsky, quoting other sources, she was left alone. Her companion didn't show up. He was about to leave his house when an old man appeared before him. The companion invited him in and offered him the usual hospitality. And he forgot about his meeting with a maiden. Who was this stranger? We are told it was Prophet Elijah, sent to keep the two mystics from accomplishing their goal. It was too early to put an end to exile. A far-fetched legend, as with everything about the Virgin of Ludmir, it all remains muddled. Did she remarry? Some say yes. Others say she remained a virgin until she passed away. Where did she die? In Safed? How old was she? It was thought to be in 1888. Some also think that she died in 1905 in Jerusalem. There was no eulogy at her funeral. No article made mention on her passing. Where is her tomb? Menashe Unger believes to have found it at the Mount of Olives Cemetery. I knew Menashe Unger. He was working at the Morgen Journal, the Yiddish daily, while I was working at the other Yiddish daily Forwards. An author of countless articles and several enthralling works on Hasidism, he and I spoke often. We both shared an admiration for this literature that inspires warmth and tenderness, faith and hope to those in need. He is the first one who ever spoke to me of the Virgin of Ludmir. But it was Anski, friend of my favorite Jewish historian, Dubnov. I loved Dubnov for so many reasons. First, because he loved Hasidism, whereas the other historian, Gretz, hated Hasidism with fervor, with Hasidic, anti-Hasidic fire. So I love Dubnov, and also because he, the great historian, finished his life in Riga. He could have come to America, could have come to London, could have come to Palestine. He was invited everywhere. But he wanted to stay with his people, our people, in Riga. And he was shot December 7, 1941, by a Gestapo officer who had been his student in Germany. Anski, we said, visited Ludmir. He visited other Jewish enclaves and villages in Eastern and Central Europe. Everywhere he went, he tried desperately to gather anything that represented Jewish life and survival, its traditions, culture, ambitions, its fears and triumphs, its nightmares and dreams. And in conclusion, this is how he describes his mission. Quote, "With every old man who dies, with every fire that breaks out, with every exile we suffer, we lose part of our past. The best example of our traditional lives, our customs, our beliefs, are vanishing. The old tales and songs and melodies will soon be forgotten. In short, our past, sanctified by the blood and tears of so many innocent martyrs, is vanishing and will soon be erased." End of quote. My good friends, these words were not written in 1940, 41, 42, 43, 45. They were written in 1914. Aren't they applicable to our own times? From what used to be a great and flourishing Jewish community in Ludmir, who remained? And what about the other cities and villages in Poland, in Romania, in Hungary, in Lithuania? It is possible that 70 years ago, in malevolent evil, the book has entered history. It happens that winds of madness blow in history. So, 70 years ago, madness, sheer, cruel madness, has entered history with the goal of debasing the humanity of man and destroying a people drunk with God and obsessed with sparks of eternity. Is it possible that that madness, the fallout of that madness, is still being felt today? Whatever the answer. And these are, of course, the words of farewell this year, as we are about to conclude this year's series. Whatever the answer, despair cannot be it. Despair is never an answer. Despair is only a question. Thank you.
You've just heard the last of three lectures in the annual series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was titled A Woman in Hasidism, The Maiden of Lutmir. Introducing Professor Wiesel was the director of the B'nai B'rith Hillel Foundation, Rabbi Joseph Pollack. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Tim Skolb, with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Pozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.